Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Norma Walden, chair of the club's International Relations Forum. We also welcome our online and radio listeners, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker today, William Carlson, is a journalist and author who formerly worked for the New York Times and has strong ties to the Bay Area because for two decades he was a reporter and editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. He also taught journalism at UC Berkeley and San Francisco State. William Carlson was a finalist for the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory writing for a series of articles on the AIDS crisis. He and his wife lived for many years in Antigua, Guatemala. They currently reside in Sonoma, California. Following our program, Mr. Carlson will sign copies of his book, Jungle of Stone, the true story of two men, their extraordinary journey, and the discovery of the lost civilization of the Maya. Today is the publication date. Please help me welcome William Carlson.
Well, what a pleasure to be here. When I was standing in the back, I looked at some of the luminaries that had been here before and noted that every president since Theodore Roosevelt had been here at one time or another before the Commonwealth Club. And then I read the next part, which said, speakers are not paid an honoraria. And I thought, well, that's fine, because that's when I first talked to my publicist about coming here, she said, you know, there would be a paid audience here. And I said, a paid audience? You mean I have to pay the audience to come to see it? I knew it might not be, you know, the most popular subject, but we got that cleared up pretty quickly. I worked for the Chronicle for 25 years. And in daily journalism. And so when finally I left the Chronicle, one of the great things I think every reporter and journalist loves to do or loves to think about is writing long form. And this, oh, for the people that are on the radio or the podcast, they can't see this. It's not that large. But as you can all see, this is long form. So it was a thrill to write, to be able to expand on a subject such as this. Let me just give a little background, and I'll read some of the book. But I'd like to say that, just as an overview, Jungle of Stone is a is a book that is, at its heart, an adventure story. But it's more than that. It's a book about discovery and what that discovery came to mean. It's been, some people think of it as a book along the lines of Indiana Jones, because it is a great adventure story. It's kind of a rip-roaring adventure story. And I got a recent review, even though the book came out today, an early review, by the Times Tampa paper, in which the reviewer said, this book makes Indiana Jones look like a stay-at-home slacker. The two men in 1839 that went to Central America were very different men. One was a New York lawyer, born in New York, and he was very gregarious. He was small, compact man, red-bearded, and kind of packed with nervous energy. And the other man was a British artist, an architect, businessman, quite the opposite. Tall, clean-shaven, and in maybe the British manner, very, very reserved. A man of very few words, and a man who expressed himself through his art. So they had very different personalities, but they formed a very strong bond because both of them had traveled earlier through Egypt, not together, separately, through Egypt, through Italy and Greece and Egypt and the Middle East. And it was there in the deserts of the Sinai. Stevens was one of the first people to ever go to a place called Petra, that they became kind of infected by this almost a pathological, like a virus, for the sense of danger and the sense of quest and an insatiable appetite for curiosity, a insatiable curiosity about antiquities. So they were very successful in New York. Stevens had written about his journeys in the Middle East, made a lot of money. They were bestsellers. Catherwood had opened up a roundabout, a panorama in New York City that was very successful. In those days, they had these roundabouts because this was before video and before photography. So he had all of his canvases of Jerusalem and of Thebes and places that he had gone in Egypt. And you could stand in the middle and turn around and see the entire scenes of these cities. So they were very comfortable in New York, but it wasn't enough. They had heard rumors that there were stones, carved stones that had been found in Central America and Mexico. It was irresistible to them. So, unfortunately, at that time in Central America, the region was in the midst of a very vicious civil war. And to get cover, in a way, Stevens, who was very much politically connected in New York, got President Martin Van Buren to appoint him as the diplomat to Central America. Well, it didn't work out very well. Among other things, when they got there, they were taken hostage at gunpoint by the insurgents. That was one of the incidents. But eventually he always said that he traveled throughout all of Central America in search of the government, because the government, the federal government, really didn't exist. It was dissolving at the time in the Civil War. So when it came to the end of his diplomatic responsibilities, he and Catherwood set out to look for these stones in the jungle, which was what they always wanted to do, and that's what they were going to do from the get-go. Their first place, they landed in a place called Izabal. They went up a river called the Rio Dulce, beautiful river, and landed in a tiny little town of Izabal, and then went through the mountains, and on their way to Guatemala City, where Stevens was supposed to start his diplomatic responsibilities, duties, the way was blocked by the Indian uprising and insurgents. So they made a little detour. But the detour was perfect because it was across the border into Honduras, right on the other side, to a place called Copan, a tiny little village. And maybe some of you have been there. And when they arrived, it was a small valley, the Copan River, with a river running through it, with thick jungle. And they found a guide who was able to cut his way through the jungle with a machete and get them across the river and into the ruins. And I'd like to read a passage of this experience that they had. I might add, just I'm going to step back for a moment. Before they had gotten that far, and they had to go over a mountain called Miko Mountain. And this was the main entry at the time to all of Central America for all the goods that came into the country. And it was anything but a highway that they were familiar with in the United States. And so they had to go up this mountain track. It was the rainy season. And even though they were men of artistic temperament, Stevens wrote, because they were very practical men, they were armed to the teeth. They didn't know what to expect. So this is from the book. Each had a double brace of pistols, ammunition, large hunting knives, strapped in belts across their bodies. Augustine, a young man they picked up in Belize, their first stop, was also their cook and interpreter and their factotum. He was given a pistol and a sword. They mounted at 8 o'clock and set off straight for Mico Mountain and the old Spanish highway, the Camino Real, which wound 120 miles inland to Guatemala City. It was over this road that most of the trade of Central America passed. It was, however, like no road or highway back home. It consisted of little more than a steep mountain track, which at this time of year, the rainy season runs from June to November, this was October, was filled with treacherous mud holes, narrow, slippery gullies, and deep ravines, which were exposed tree roots stretching across the path three or more feet high. Rain poured down as they rode. They were soon overwhelmed by blue muck and the sweltering heat and were barely able to squeeze through the ravines. The first hours proved a hard test for the two men's friendship. Up to this point, their journey had been smooth going, even through the rough seas on their way to Belize. Stephen's mule fell first. I lifted myself off her back and flung clear of the roots and the trees, but not of the mud, he wrote. I had escaped from a worse danger. My dagger fell from its sheath and stood upright with the handle in the mud, a foot of naked blade. Mr. Catherwood, Stephen's usual moniker for his friend, was thrown next, and at full volume cursed Stevens for dragging him into this godforsaken country. Soon all discourse ended entirely as the two men, coated in mud, struggled just to stay on their mounts. The jungle became thicker and the climb more precipitous. The trees and forest growth closed in around them so completely that little daylight came through. After 8 hours of grueling, steaming labor, most of it just to stay atop their mounts, they finally reached a wild mountain stream called, appropriately enough, El Arroyo de Muerto, or Stream of the Dead. They stopped next to a cool, clear stream, their stomachs growling ravenously for their first meal of the day. As they rested under the shade of a large tree, dipping their cups in the water, their spirits lifted. And, as Stevens recalled, we spoke with contempt of railroads, cities, hotels. Then Augustine unrolled their provisions, 3 days' supply of bread, roasted fowl, and hard-boiled eggs. The scene that presented itself was too shocking, even for the strongest nerves, he wrote. Augustine had mistakenly put in with the food a large paper roll of gunpowder that had broken, leaving all the food thoroughly seasoned with this new condiment. All the beauty of the scene, all our equanimity, everything but our tremendous appetites left us in a moment. So, traveling inland into Guatemala and then into Honduras, at one point they were taken hostage. And that's a great scene in the book. I mean, a great scene. Stevens was an incredible writer, as Catherwood was a phenomenal artist and illustrator. And there's many illustrations in the book of his. They get to Copan. I'm back where I started from. They come to the river. And let me read this section of the book. When they came to the river's edge and looked across, they were stunned by what they saw. They had been expecting scattered stone ruins at best. But what appeared on the other side of the river was a massive stone wall that rose to a height of nearly 100 feet. A large section had fallen, eroded and undermined by the river at its base. Stevens and Catherwood had read one eyewitness account and one vague historical reference to the ruins at Copan. Yet the enormity of the wall in front of them and its smooth surface took their breath away. They had been to Italy, Greece, the Middle East. They had seen the pyramids and the remnants of ancient cities. But this place was assumed to have been occupied by savages. This was Aboriginal America. No one expected its vanished people to engineer a solid face of stone rising far into the air and spanning hundreds of feet along the riverbank. So they climbed the stairs up to the terrace. Jose, their guide, went to work again, hacking a pathway across a level ground through the underlying foliage. And soon they made out what looked like the side of a pyramid. A short time later, stumbling through the trees and underbrush, they came upon something they had never imagined possible and stopped in their tracks, struck with wonder. It was a tall monument. Of such size and artistic mastery, wrote Stevens, that it equaled the finest sculptures they had seen in Egypt. The two men had ventured 2,000 miles, risked disease and injury, traveled in great danger through a land torn by civil war, all in the hopes of what they might find. This monolith alone exceeded anything they had dared to imagine. The massive 12-foot stone idol loomed over them, sculpted from top to bottom on all four sides in bold relief. Quote, "The front was a figure of a man," Stevens wrote, "curiously and richly dressed, and the face evidently a portrait, solemn, stern, and well-fitted to excite terror. The back was of a different design, unlike anything we had ever seen before, and the sides were covered with hieroglyphics. The sight of this unexpected monument put to rest once and forever in our minds all uncertainty in regards to the character of American antiquities." Ahead, Jose continued slicing through the dimly lit jungle, making a path through the tangle of vines and undergrowth. The forest was so thick with trees, immense grasping strangler figs, that it was difficult at times to see very far. The tops of the trees formed a solid canopy that blocked the midday sun. The men tripped and climbed over roots and vines that snaked along the forest floor. Mosses, lianas, epiphytes wrapped themselves around every available tree and limb. Even Jose lost his way, leading them down several dead ends to walls of impenetrable green foliage. Before long, however, he guided them to 14 more carved stone monuments, similar in appearance to the first. Some had toppled to the ground. Some were half buried. Some in creepers, covered in creepers and roots. One was, quote, "locked in a close embrace of branches of trees and almost lifted from the earth," Stevens recalled. One, standing with its altar before it in a grove of trees which grew around it, seemed to shade and shroud it as a sacred thing. In the solemn stillness of the woods, it seemed a divinity mourning over a fallen people. As they went on in the diffused light, they began to make out half-buried walls, huge, round, sculpted altars, and other carved stone fragments. Fat roots of the strangler figs wrapped themselves like pythons around broken cornices and rows of sculpted death heads. All around them, trees grew out of the great shattered structures. Enormous mounds of stones towered above them. Trunks and roots had torn apart and dislodged ochre-colored building stones, mottled with gray-green patches of lichen, and had sent the precisely cut stone blocks tumbling down in huge piles at the foot of the pyramids. Yet for all its jumbled desolation, the remains left by the natural force of the jungle still displayed delicate tracings and intricate sculptured heads and figures, artistry carved into stone and frozen in time. Set in the overpowering forest, it was bewildering devastation and mystery, too much to grasp in a single take. The two men stumbled through the jungle after Jose in a state of disbelief. Yet Stevens realized almost immediately that they were in the presence of something extraordinary, something with the potential to change the understanding of history. These were not the remains of a raw and unrefined people, he wrote, but works of art that proved, quote, the people who once occupied the continent of America were not savages. Stevens was alive as never before, his every sense and nerve stretched to its limit. Even the stillness of the jungle caught his attention, and the whispers he detected in it. And then I'll read a passage from Stevens' book. I'll give you an idea of what kind of writer he is. The only sounds that disturbed the quiet of this buried city were the noise of the monkeys moving across the top of the trees and the cracking of dry branches broken by their weight. They moved over our heads in long, swift processions, 40 and 50 at a time, some with little ones wound in their long arms, walking out to the end of boughs and holding on with their hind feet or a curl of their tail, sprang to a branch of the next tree, and with a noise like a current of wind, passed on into the depths of the forest. It was the first time we had seen these mockeries of humanity, and with the strange monuments around us, they seemed like wandering spirits of the departed race guarding the ruins of their former inhabitants. So they spent several hours walking through the ruins, and eventually they were completely drained. And they sat down on the terrace that they first had climbed to, emotionally and physically exhausted, and tried to comprehend what they had just found. Who were the people, they wondered, who had built these monuments and pyramids, and how long ago? The inhabitants of the valley had no idea. There were no written records, and apparently no oral accounts passed down from generation to generation. Stevens wrote, all was mystery, dark, impenetrable mystery. In Egypt, the temples stood out on the desert sands in open, unguarded nakedness. Here, the temples and pyramids lay buried under thick jungle, lost to time and history. Stevens sought to capture the wonder of it. Architecture, sculpture, and painting, all the arts which embellish life, had flourished in this overgrown forest. Orators, warriors, and statesmen, beauty, ambition, and glory had lived and passed away, and none know, none know that such things had been or could tell of their past existence. It laid before us as a shattered ship in the midst of the ocean, her mast gone, her name effaced, her crew perished, and none to tell whence she came, to whom she belonged, or how long her voyage, or what caused her destruction. And that's the end of the passage. And this is the end of the first part of the book. It was a mystery of staggering implications, but there seemed no immediate answers. Not only had Stevens and Catherwood found in Copan evidence of an advanced, seemingly ancient civilization, but the ruins lay in the jungle heart of America, a place where no one believed such a civilization could have existed. They knew immediately the challenge they faced, that this could not be the only proof of a civilization in the region, that there must be other signs of ancient settlements in the jungle, other ruins for them to find. And when their existence was made known to the world, human curiosity would not be satisfied until the answers to all their mysteries, their untold stories, were unearthed as well. So that is the end of the first part of the book. There's a lot more. And in the end, they went on over 3 years to discover more than 40 cities in Guatemala, Honduras, and in Mexico, Chiapas, Mexico, and in the Yucatan. They came back and they wrote two sets of books. Stephen's writing the books and Catherwood illustrating them. They were phenomenal bestsellers at their time. Harper Brothers literally could not keep the presses running long enough and fast enough to meet the demand. They're obscure figures today. But one of the great things in writing a story like this, writing a book like this for me, was the moment of discovery. The thrill, but also the moment of discovery. And for someone like me writing a book like this, what was known before that discovery and what was known after? So if you imagine, for example, Copernicus. Before Copernicus, it was well known that the sun went around the earth. Afterwards, Copernicus had changed everything. And Galileo and the solar system, Darwin, Einstein, all of these major discoveries have changed our thinking. Now, I don't put them on the same league as the men I just mentioned, but the significance of what they found was they discovered that these people were the people that built these ruins. For the first time, they were convinced, because of the vastness of what they found and the unity of the civilization they found, were made by indigenous population of the Americas, by the Indians, the native Indians of America, who had the creativity, the intelligence, and the imagination. But prior to their discovery, the prevailing thinking was very white and Eurocentric, and it was that if there were any ruins that were in a jungle that could be found, they had to be the seafaring Phoenicians who had come over earlier, centuries before, or the Egyptians, or the lost Atlantis, people from the lost Atlantis. But the prevailing theory, the most important theory at the time, was the lost tribes of Israel. They couldn't believe that people, the Native Americans, could have created a civilization like this on such a level, such mastery of such artistry and sophistication. And the other thing that I found fascinating and significant was that if you imagine that humans went to another planet like ours 15,000 years ago, and now we come and we arrive at this planet, and we see that, in fact, after 15,000 years, they have a civilization very much like our own. They have a political hierarchy. They have written language. They have architecture. All of the attributes of civilization, very much similar after 15,000 years. Well, that's what happened. 15,000 years ago, hunters, a small group of hunters, now they're pretty convinced not more than 1,000, came across the Bering Straits because it was a land bridge, because of it was the Ice Age, and came to Alaska. And after the melting in the Ice Age and the seas rose, the Bering Strait was covered in ocean and see again. Those 1,000 people, now they know through DNA evidence, populated the entire Western Hemisphere. And for 15,000 years, there was no contact with the rest of the world. And the whole idea of that civilizations could only be passed from one part of the world to the other through a thing called diffusion, and in this case, from the old world to the new world, was shattered by this discovery. And I must say, there's another part to this book that was very important to me, and that was the part about the Maya. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the Maya, because it's a section in the book. The Maya, it created a civilization that lasted 1,500 years. It started in around 800 BC, they now believe. At one point in 200 BC, when the Greeks and Romans were in their florescence, the Maya had built a city in the middle of the Patan in northern Guatemala that was considered the largest monumental city in the world at the time. They reached their peak in between 300, 400 AD and 800. They had a written language, the only written language in the Americas. Very sophisticated astronomy. They could predict eclipses. They studied the stars. They had great circles of time that they had worked out. They invented the zero. They built these incredible palaces and temples and fed their people. And at one time, in an area the size of Maryland, in the middle of the jungle in northern Guatemala and southern Yucatan, 10 million people lived in an area that now sustains about 500,000. So they were incredibly successful. What happened? And this is the story that the Maya can teach us today. There have been many counter theories about why the Maya civilization disappeared and collapsed. But Mayanist scholars now pretty much have a lot of common ground. And one was they were too successful. Overpopulation. They exceeded their carrying capacity of their agriculture. They had 40 plus, more than 40 cities, and they were all city-states, all run by individual dynasties, a little bit like Greece, you know, with Athens and Sparta. They had a overriding culture, same creation story, the same language, the same hieroglyphics, a unity of culture, but they had a lot of different political states, so they were at war quite a bit. And especially as the resources ran out, more and more so. So soon, there was malnutrition, starvation, and disease. The royal elites and the common people were so separated because the royal elites in their dynasties, and maybe some of you know this if you've been to some of the ruins, every new king had to build another pyramid or two over the prior pyramids in self-aggrandizement. And these took up enormous resources. Trees had to be cut down to burn the limestone that made the cement and the blocks and the plaster, because these were all plastered smoothly and in brilliant colors, all of the pyramids and the temples and the palaces. And so a widening gap got wider. There were rebellions. We could call this today income inequality. But the final thing that did the Maya in was they had degraded and deforested their land to such an extent that they created a regional microclimate change that resulted in decades-long severe droughts. Scientists are amazing today the way they can figure this out by looking at sediment and rivers and so on. And it was this that essentially did the Maya in at the very end, emptied out their cities for the jungle then to reclaim. And 1,000 years later, Stevens and Catherwood showed up to bring it back to life. They have broken the Maya code now, and they know the histories of these dynasties. And they're all fascinating stories. But let me tell you a story about how I did the book. When I first thought of doing the book, my wife and I lived in Guatemala for many years, off and on. I wanted to follow their trail. I wanted to get the sense of what it was like. You know, for them to experience all of these ruins. And I went to all the ruins, 2,500 miles, 3 months, but they went on mules. And the closest thing I could come to replicating a mule was my 1985 beat-up Toyota Corolla without air conditioning or even a radio. So I followed their trail through the mountains and through the jungles, much different in many ways today because there are better roads, obviously. But a lot of it is very much the same as it was 170 years ago. A lot of the villages and a lot of the rural areas. And I remember in the last leg coming back home to Antigua, where we lived, I was going through probably the worst part of the jungle, on a horrible road, a stony road, mud-caked. It was after the rains. And I thought to myself, as I jostled along the bone-cracking roads in my Corolla, all I could think about was the group of Japanese auto workers who 20 years before were bolting together my Corolla. And I just prayed they had done a good job. But the Corolla, which my wife and I later came to affectionately call the mule, and I made it back to Antigua. We survived. But thank you very much, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Our thanks to William Carlson, author and journalist. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program at the Commonwealth Club of California titled Jungle of Stone, the true story of two men, their extraordinary journey, and the discovery of the lost civilization of the Maya. We'll now welcome audience questions. Microphone right here, or I can bring it around to you if you get up. Questions?
Over here. There's some over here.
Oh.
I was just wondering, is there any place that you can go to see the paintings? Are there any paintings that still exist that he did?
There are paintings. There are murals. Most of them are hard to find. In Chichen Itza, there are painted murals. I might just explain that in many of these ruins are now very accessible. And millions of people visit the ruins, the Mayan ruins. And especially the ones in the Yucatan because they're close to resorts like Cancun. And many tourists in Cancun, they get on a bus and an hour and a half later, they're at Chichen Itza or Tulum, which is right on the coast of the Caribbean. And I always call it the Maya resort city. But the really fine, and there are some very fine murals and paintings in brilliant colors that still, even the colors have held up today, are pretty hard to get to. There's one place called Bonampak, which I went to, It's in an area that it's in on the border of Guatemala and Mexico. It's in an area that used to be well known because the Zapatistas controlled that area, but it's the Lacandon Indians live there still, and you can get there by river and go on the river. But a lot of the art still remains on vessels, on clay pots. And some of those are in the book. You can see pictures of them in the book. So painting was one of the things they did. By the way, one of the other things they did is they created the scribes. They didn't have priests. The Maya kings were the priests. They were the shamans. They were the connection to the other world. But the scribes were very important. And the scribes wrote books in these hieroglyphics. Accordion-like books that would open up, very long books. And only a few of these remain, partly because the Spanish, when they came, the Spanish in the Yucatan, gathered up all of the idols and all of the books and burned them because they were trying to convert all of the Indians to Christianity. But many of these books disappeared also because this is a wet, tropical climate, and those they were bark paper, pounded bark paper books, and they have perished. But they carved a lot on the stones. And so what we know mostly about their history is from their stones and their monuments, which, by the way, when Catherwood went and drew these and illustrated these, some have been weathered and lost. And so Mayanist scholars go to Catherwood's drawings to see the hieroglyphics. And he did them so accurately. So I don't know. I maybe went on too long, but about that.
So fascinating experience. How old was Stevens and Catherwood when they first landed at Copan, and then for how long were they going around and exploring and finding other monuments?
They started in 1839. Stevens was born in 1805, so he was 35, 34. Catherwood was 6 years older, born in 1799. They spent 9 months the first time. Catherwood got deathly ill. They had bout after bout of malaria. I mean, the hardship that they went through, the mosquitoes, the ticks, the poisonous snakes, it's indescribable. I mean, it does make Indiana Jones look like a stay-at-home slacker. I'm telling you, it really did. Catherwood, they went to Uxmal. They got to Uxmal, and then Catherwood became so sick, he had to be carried out to the port and back to New York. They wrote their first books. A year or so later, they went back to the Yucatan to finish what they had started. They knew there were more. And so another 9 months later, they came back to New York and wrote the second set of books. By the way, the book also ends, the last part of the book. What I found in doing the book, it's always a great thing when you research and you find things out and the richness of the material. I was very lucky to find the materials of, and I think really the thing that made me write the book after I came back to San Francisco from Antigua was the discovery that John L. Stevens' personal papers were at the Bancroft Library at Berkeley, where I was teaching journalism at the time. And so I couldn't let it go. They had a remarkable and enduring relationship. And so the last part of the book is after their discoveries, after the writing of their books, and Catherwood also produced an oversized book of 25 plates. Almost all of them are in the book, hand-colored. And they're worth now you can't find them. I mean, they're worth $150,000 if you can find a hand-colored book by Catherwood of the original views of the monuments. But they had this wonderful relationship right to the end of their lives. And so I followed them through the end of their lives. They didn't live that long afterwards, and they had remarkable lives afterward. And they teamed up one more time, and they built the railroad across Panama during the gold rush. Stevens was the president of the Panama Railroad, and he died doing it. I don't want to give away too much. There's good spoilers here, you know. But they both died tragic lives at the end of their lives. Yeah.
Your final stunning statement about your talk is corroborated by a couple of, by probably many people. And probably many people in the audience know there's a lot been written about Catherine Wood and Stevens. What I'm saying is that I've finished a couple of books by Elizabeth Colbert, who talks about drought and other environmental catastrophic problems that we are dealing with now, and she confirms your conclusion that drought, among other things, they were very successful, and they just destroyed their water supply, and they ran out of water. Well, Elizabeth Colbert, K-O-L-B-E-R-T.
Yeah, no, I know the books that she's written about climate change, but I didn't know that she talked about the Maya. That's
well, it's in there somewhere.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, this is completely fascinating, and the science backs up your conclusions about the Mayans just simply disappearing because they were so successful, and they destroyed the land that they lived on.
Right, and
what's something that we should know about, and we should learn about history, but we're not very good at that.
Well, what's interesting is that the Maya didn't have the benefit that we have of knowing this.
Yeah, that's right.
They didn't know that, you know?
That's right.
But we do.
We do. And we have people called the merchants of doubt.
Yes, merchants of doubt. Well put.
So confusion. All right.
Thank you. Could you just put the Aztec civilization and the Olmecs and Toltecs, and could you just kind of put those into some kind of relationship?
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. The first civilization actually was in South America, but it was a very, very primitive civilization. They had built some mounds and so on in Peru and in those areas. There's one called the Moca civilization. Very, very unsophisticated, very, very crude. But the Olmecs started in, I think, 1500 B.C. And they were on the Mexican coast along where Veracruz is now. And they were very successful. They created a very sophisticated and successful small – there are only three sites that they have found – and they made these giant heads out of basalt stone. And a lot of the things that they did were transferred throughout Mesoamerica. They think that the ball game started there. And if you know anything about the Maya, every city in the Maya world had a ball court where a ball game was played. They think that started there. And many of the traditions may have started with the Olmec, although the Olmec and the Maya never had any direct connection. There were the Zapotecs as well in Oaxaca, who were fairly sophisticated, around the same time as the Maya. But now the Aztecs and the Inca, this is an interesting thing. The Aztecs and the Inca, those were the civilizations that the Spanish encountered when they came. And one thing to keep in mind is the Spanish weren't really interested in discovery. They were interested in gold. I mean, I've been to Extremadura in Spain, where all the conquistadors came from, and they were all soldiers in the wars against the Moors, and they all wanted to be rich and gentlemen. And the opportunity to go to the New World was everything to them. They could make a name for themselves. They could become rich and go back to Spain. And the other thing that the Spanish did was they wanted to convert everyone to Christianity. That was the overriding drive that they had. And so between those two things, they destroyed the culture, as I mentioned before, burning the books and the idols and converted them. But the conquistadors also tore down all of the monuments and temples and used the stones to build their churches and to build their buildings. So they were anything but discoverers. But let me put it in perspective. The Aztecs are to us in time, 500 years ago, what the Maya were to the Aztecs 500, 600 years before. And it's not known whether the Aztecs even knew that the Maya existed. There were Maya descendants. There are 7 million Maya Indians that still live in Guatemala. They didn't disappear, but they lost their civilization. But so it's questionable whether the Aztecs even knew the Maya civilization existed, because it was buried under the jungle, even though it's only hundreds of miles away, not that far. So the Maya really were ancient, an ancient civilization, you know, in reference to, say, the Incas and the Aztecs. Does that put it in perspective for you? Yeah.
Yes, I'm sure you're familiar with the writings of Jared Diamond.
Yes, of course.
And his book Collapse.
Of course.
And what you talk about is so similar to the destruction, self-destruction of so many civilizations.
Right.
And I think you mentioned the population went from 10 million to 500,000.
Well, 10
and
million,
over what
I
period
don't know
of time did this happen? And can you talk a little bit about, you know, that demise and what happened during
well,
the
at their peak in 800 A.D., there were cities like Tikal that were immense. And they know this now because, you know, they had the ruins and the temples and the palaces. Those were always at the core. But the Maya always built family compounds on mounds. And they have discovered all these smaller mounds all stretched out around, say, for just to take one example, Tikal. And so if they could extrapolate the population based on, you know, an estimate of how many people were in each family and each family compound and so on. So around 800 AD, they had reached this unbelievable level and estimated to be as much as 10 million people living in this fairly small area. Now, what happened right after that and how fast it decreased? I'm not saying that it decreased to 500,000 immediately. But in that same area today, only 500,000 people live. So that's what I meant to say. I don't know if that clarifies it for you.
Here's a question back here.
Yeah, I once heard some notion that Central Mexicans might have attacked the Maya. And I wonder if can you put this in the context of Teotihuacan in terms of time? Or
Teotihuacan was a very, very important center in Mexico and in Mesoamerica. It was a very powerful place. I've never been there, but I've seen many photos of it. It's huge. And they did have contact with Maya. In fact, at one point, but it was one city. It was one entire city, Teotihuacan. It's northeast, I believe, of Mexico City. You can go there today. It's apparently, I want to go. I haven't been there yet. But at one point, they were very militaristic and very successful. They invaded the Maya and actually took over Tikal. And this is in the history. This is on the hieroglyphs. And then they went on, either another generation later or so, went on to Copan and founded the dynasty in Copan as well. But they were absorbed into the Maya culture and civilization after a generation or two. You know, they married into, if you will, and they were absorbed into the Maya culture. I'm not sure exactly how long Teotihuacan lasted or what the period of time was, but it was concurrent with the Maya, at its height, at its zenith. And it was a very powerful place, Teotihuacan.
You said that our Maya is still existing.
Yes.
How does one know that they are descendants of the Maya? And is the language similar? You know, could that lead to better interpretations?
If you ever go to Guatemala, you can probably figure out who's Mayan, pure Mayan. And all you have to do is look at the runes and look at the sculptures on the runes, and you'll see a very similar facial features. There are 7 million Maya, pure Mayan Indians in Guatemala, and they're the poorest of the population. They hold on to their culture. They have a mixture of Christian and their own religion, and their own traditions. There's a place called Chichicastenango that you can go in the same church. Up on the altar is Christ, and so, and in the back is all the idols from their past. 35 languages are now in existence, Mayan languages, that came from the mother language in that period of time. And many of the Maya can't communicate with each other. They can't converse. The languages have split up in such a way. So did that answer your question? By the way, the Maya are wonderful, wonderful people. And the women, I'm sure many of you know, the women, the textiles and the colors, they're renowned. And the men generally wear Western clothes, but the women hang on to that tradition. And if you go around Guatemala and you go to the villages, every village has a different pattern and a different color of their huipils. It's a marvelous place to visit. I can't recommend it enough, Guatemala.
I find it fascinating that the human animal is unable to evolve beyond its self-destructive protocol. And that's what you're describing here today. We cannot evolve as educated, quote-unquote, educated as we are. We cannot evolve beyond self-destruction. And that's where America is headed today. And we can't do anything about it. Well, that's amazing.
Hopefully we can. I'm an optimist. I'm an optimist. We have the Maya to help us.
No, but that's my point. No, okay. Even though we're educated
about that,
we're still stupid. The middle of the bell curve is stupid in all evolved culture. It's amazing.
Right.
Our thanks to William Carlson, journalist and author of Jungle of Stone, the true story of two men, their extraordinary journey, and the discovery of the lost civilization of the Maya. We also thank our audience here and our listening audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in its 113th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.
Thank you so much.
It's terrific.
Thank you so much.